This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, Episode 18, for Thursday, July 30th, 2009, The Legend of Bagger Welch. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store. Here we are live again in the studio with Out of Line After Hours. Great to have all you who have joined us here online, and for those of you who are taking the podcast version. And of course, always joining us, as he does every Thursday night, Mr. Auto Extremist Peter DeLorenzo. Peter, great having you here, as
John,
always.
John, how are you? Good to be here. Another week of changes at General Motors.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get into all that. Hey, what'd you write about? What was your column this week? Because I have to confess, I did not get a chance to go read it.
I forgot. Oh. It was about the German provision.
Oh, and we're going to talk about that. Oh, yeah, 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 because that was my auto blog entry as well. And also joining us, David Welch from Business Week. Great having you here back with us.
Thanks for having me, John. Always good to be here.
I'm surprised you could tear yourself away from preparing for the Highland Games, David. Am I right?
Yes, you are. I'll be there in full regalia.
Are you going to throw a caber?
No, I'm
no. He's a piper.
Candy ass. Now, if you said you're going to play the pipes and throw the caber at the same time, I would shake you by the hand.
You know, I actually watch those guys enviously because that looks like a hell of a lot of fun throwing cabers and kegs and you know, heaving stuff around.
Where is that? The Highland Games.
Livonia.
Yeah, it's in Livonia.
Oh, Greenmead.
Greenmead. Yeah.
Don't you think it should be in Highland Park?
No. Highland.
Highland.
Highland, Michigan.
Oh, well.
Yeah, so you working on some big cover story? Or what?
I just ran a cover story.
Yeah, he just had a big one.
On the incredible shrinking boomer economy.
Which means what?
Baby boomers pulling back.
Saving money.
Trying to actually save money, yeah.
So this wasn't an automotive story.
No, there was an automotive element in that Mercedes and to a lesser extent, BMW are sort of looking at what they're going to do. With the possibility that their boomer customers, people who've bought so many of their cars for the past 20, 30 years, are pulling back. And, you know, Mercedes has, you know, sort of a Gen Y experiment where they're trying to talk to these people and grab the next generation of potential Mercedes customers and bring them in. Other than that, they're just going to sell used cars to people without any money.
Oh, yeah.
Well, hey, when I interviewed the guys at BMW, and this was back in April at the New York show, they said, well, you know, we have this great certified use program. And I said, okay, that's great, but that doesn't keep your factories running. I mean, you don't build used cars. And now they are getting some, you know, some boomers are buying minis because there's still some snooty European cachet to driving a mini, and you can get in with
who would drive a mini, for God's sakes?
Some very disturbed people.
No doubt about it.
Yeah. Like one Mr. David Welch, right? Yeah.
And who would pay? Mr. Jim Hall.
Yeah. Oh, and Jim Hall's got one,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Even worse than buying money. Who would pay a lot of money to custom one out?
Afterwards, I don't understand. Have the factory do it for you. Just don't be bothered.
And that third voice that you're all hearing, actually fourth voice, is Jim Hall from 2953 Analytics joining us here live on Autoline After Hours. Great having you here.
I can do fifth voice, too.
Well, we can all do voices.
Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm schizophrenic, and so am I.
Right. Jeff, never heard that joke before.
Really?
So
you must move in a small circle.
What is 2953 Analytics?
It's an industry analysis practice, and when we finally get it down, we'll probably do business.
When Ben was asking me, you know, how do we identify Jim, I said, just put 2953 Analytics. And he says, yeah, but what does he do there? And I thought, that's a good question.
It was named for Rick Wagoner's birthday.
That was a coincidence. It really was. There's this whole thing about naming things, and the idea of naming a business after yourself seems so egocentric. It really does. And there are other partners in other parts of the world. I wouldn't do it. And so I'm sitting here, you know, what's the antithesis of a name? What's the number? So it is a significant number from an automotive standpoint.
In what way?
It has some significance.
I know. That's what I'm probing at here.
It is significant.
Okay, since we're not going to get an answer on that, let's talk about the news that really broke today, even. And Mark Royce, Peter, pick it up. I mean, here's a guy who's been running Australia for General Motors, their Holden operations. His father used to be president of General Motors, and now they've just made him vice president of engineering.
Of all of engineering. Mark's one of my favorite guys at GM.
True car guy.
A guy that the enthusiasts out there would really relate to. He's one of us.
Probably the last thing that he did in this market, best known for, would have been Pontiac Solstice, right?
Well, yeah, but he...
The performance stuff.
Yeah, he did all the performance stuff.
The V06, the CTSV, Cobalt SS, all of that stuff was Mark.
Yeah.
And I talked to a designer at GM today, and they're pretty thrilled that he's got the job because he likes cars, he understands cars. I mean, they said when he was in North America, you walk into his office, and he just had... all the cool stuff that says he's into cars.
It sends a real positive message for General Motors. I mean, it should for enthusiasts out there watching, because this guy is one of the good guys, one of the true believers, and he will get things done.
And he understands that if the car ain't good, you shouldn't even be in the business.
Right.
And will push for... I mean, he had influences on cars that were not performance products, that were good influences. And in Australia, he was basically kicking some butt and taking names, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the guys in GM in product development who I talked to say he's also a good manager and a good guy to work with.
You know, he's got to be making his dad proud because, I mean, let's be real, his dad got fired. I mean, he did.
Yeah.
And one thing I always admired about Lloyd Royce was he just let it roll right off his back, or at least publicly he did. He'd show up at car shows. He'd talk to the media still after all
he's
that.
He's still
stuff.
An active supporter of General Motors.
That's right.
All the way, and yeah.
So I admire him tremendously.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the Palace coup in general, which is when he lost his position as president of GM and Bob Stempel lost the chairmanship, was that was basically the Schmale insurrection.
Yeah, that was...
And I know that's not the correct pronunciation, but that's the way I pronounce it.
That's when the reign of terror began with Schmale and his chief acolyte, Ron Zarella. That was the... when darkness fell upon the land.
You know what's interesting, though? When you go back to brand management, it was an interesting idea that might have worked if they had done it in a scientific fashion. What GM did was say, they looked at brand management and someone said, this is the miracle cancer cure. Okay, we have this clinic, and we're going to give everyone in the clinic our miracle cancer cure. And they killed the entire population of the hospital. And didn't know why. If they had done it the way they had planned on one vehicle line only and watched it and seen what did and didn't, because there were aspects of it that were actually not bad ideas that would work with some vehicles. But because of the way they did it, they could be doing stuff wrong and they would never see it.
Well, another problem that they had is they had really bland product. I mean, incredibly bland product. And they tried to lay all this brand stuff on top of
the product.
It would have worked maybe if they had good product.
Well, if you remember...
Of course, if they had good product, maybe they wouldn't need all that brand stuff.
The CTS was the first car to actually be almost cradle-to-grave brand management. Almost cradle-to-grave. The problem is the design, the original art and science, it's going to look like a Mac and it's going to look like a Saturn V in one design theme, had already started. So they got a car already that was a little out of the norm, and then they're sitting here getting these people who are really good at managing the sales of, like, Oreos. And, you know, well, I worked in consumer goods.
How about pencils?
Well, none of them were any good at pencils, you know? They weren't.
Yeah, right.
But remember, they also had, at the same time, they brought in that guy Vince Barraba and came up with the needs-based segmentation. And I remember sitting through a presentation on this, and they came up with just... the number was like 56 or something like that.
No, there were 57 need segments in the U.S. market.
Yeah, and there just happened to be 57 different GM models fitting into the...
It was... And you know that...
I mean, it's like they finished this study and said, thank God we've got 57 different models.
Yeah, we don't have to fill one model.
We don't have to do anything.
We don't have to do anything new. We address every segment. You know, the absurdity of need segmentation was that if you looked at the needs battery that was sent to customers, it wasn't a needs battery, it was a wants battery. It didn't get to what actually motivated these people. It's what the questions they answered. Everybody here familiar with the Carbon Motors police, dedicated police vehicle?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because they went around to police departments all around the country and they asked, what do you want in a police car? And they've done everything these guys wanted, but they didn't at any time stop and say, okay, now what are you willing to pay for in a police car?
Yeah.
And that's the disconnect with need segmentation. It was asking people what they wanted, and it assumed that were their absolute needs. And it wasn't. It was...
The fatal flaw of GM brand management was the underlying arrogance that drove it. beyond everything else,
right.
Which was, it doesn't matter about the product because great marketing will sell anything.
Right.
That was the fatal flaw. That was the arrogance that the Smale-Zarella era brought to General Motors, and they are just now recovering.
Well, and you could tell that that came out of consumer goods, because if you're Procter & Gamble and you've got three or four different types of laundry detergent, and it's basically all the same soap, they might have be a different color or smell a little bit. One's fresher or one's more citrusy, but it's all the same thing. That's basically just window
dressing. But one was
a
youth soap.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you can, by decree, reach this customer. And you could tell that they did that. And that's when you got the four or five models sold by different divisions that were the same thing. And then the Pontiacs, basically, they took a car that was basically an Oldsmobile and just hung talons and cladding over it.
I remember Vince Barabbat. Okay, go.
No, my favorite Jim Hall quote, which, remember when they had the Regis at the, I think it was the 98 Detroit Auto Show, it was basically a GM minivan with just, like, the triple super secret dose of Pontiac cladding and talons and just crap hanging all over it. You know, like, I mean, literally talons and pointy pieces of plastic coming off of this thing. And it was called the Regis, and Jim called it the Diculet.
Yeah, what's in a name, though? The thing that got me once was when Vince Barabbat is telling me about how brand management works. And he says, you know, it's ice cream. We're making different flavors of ice cream because everyone loves ice cream. And poor Honda, they make just vanilla. And we're going to make different ice cream. I said, yeah, well, except Honda's not making vanilla. They're actually probably making, like, chocolate chip cherry. And what we're making is vanilla. And then we're going to have vanilla with green sprinkles and vanilla with yellow sprinkles and vanilla with, because the GM cars were not that heavily differentiated. And once I remember somebody, and it might have been Vince or somebody that worked for him, was sitting here proud as punch that the P90, the first front-wheel drive Malibu, was finished out of Clinics, and he said, you know, that is the most Clinic'd car in our history. And he was proud of this. And when you realize the car that came out was a car that everybody would kind of like, but nobody cared about it. Nobody loved it. It was anodyne.
It was bland as can be.
Exactly.
And it was studied to death.
And that's what that kind of thinking does for you. It gives you this median. You know, I love the median because the median doesn't exist.
It's the lowest common denominator thinking.
Of everything.
I remember that's when I said, I can't do it anymore in my ad career. They ushered us all into the inner sanctum of the bowels of the design center, which I grew up in because I used to hang out there all the time. And they drag us down there to show the 2000 Impala. And I walked in and I saw that. I said, these guys are done. And I'm done. I can't do this. And this is the worst, just the worst clinic car. It was horrible. And I said, that was it. And, you know, a couple months later, I started out Extremis.
it's funny because the P90 car was interesting. It had one genuinely interesting feature they did on that car and never did again. Do you remember they put the face level vents up in the A-pillars?
Yeah.
And it was a great idea because you could blow air, cold air in your face without getting your hands frozen. It was one of those things you looked at and said, why didn't anybody ever do that before? And now I'm saying, why did they just walk away from it? Because it was a good answer to a question. Customers liked it, but it was in this wrapper that, you know, how do you get past that?
Right.
In a way, it's the dilemma I think that Ford's going to have with the Taurus.
In what way?
The Taurus is a vastly improved car from its predecessor. And it has this name that's important, Ford Taurus. Everybody knows. You say Taurus, they know it's a Ford. Unlike Intrigue, where people went to Dodge dealers to buy Intrigue because they were confusing it with Intrepid, and they did a horrible job launching the Intrigue name.
I remember they were hiding the Oldsmobile name on the car. It was an 8-point type
on the radio at first too, and it was molded in the backup light. So with the Taurus, they've got this name that has recognition. Now, for some people, Taurus has a negative connotation. But for a lot of buyers out there, you know, wow, a Taurus, okay. And they have this, they talk about 4 million Taurus buyers out there.
Mainstream affordability.
Correct. And those 4 million Taurus buyers are mid-sized buyers. There are a lot of customers. You know, if you think about it, when you buy a car, you filter what you want through a series of filters in your mind. First one is probably, if you want a pickup truck, you're not going to cross shop minivans, or see, it's the vehicle type. And then there are the names you will and won't consider. That's your second filter. And then when you get into the car, I want a sedan. I'll take a sedan from Ford. Now I want a big car. And you hear the name Taurus, and you're going to go, midsize, don't care. It's off your list. So they have to use this marketing to use the notoriety and the recognition of the name, but they have to counter-market what the Taurus has been.
Mm-hmm.
And their advertising is really interesting, but it's all techno. It's all about the technology in the car. You know, because talking about GM, with the lowest common denominator cars, where they thought you could sell anything, the marketing is more important.
the middle of this next decade, you can have the best car in the segment, but if you cannot adequately market it, you're going to be in just as much trouble.
Right.
That's the evil part about the next, because it's tough to find some bad cars in some segments.
I think it's tough to find a bad car just about anywhere these days, really. Well, you may not like it, but it doesn't mean it's a bad car.
When you say bad, you're talking about just pure junk.
Just pure junk.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of quality, I would mostly agree with that, but I've driven some cars recently that I just...
We're not up to segment standard.
Well, let's hear about it, Dave.
Yeah, tell us the name of a car. Gerald. No, not that kind of
name. But you can only tell us in a Scottish accent.
Which Infiniti was I complaining to you about 2 weeks ago? It was the... It was the FX50.
Yes, yes. But it has a Katana-like grill.
Oh, it was just, it's like, it was one of these experiments from a few years. No, it wasn't really that. The interior wasn't great, but it was still, it's improved over what Nissan Infiniti's been doing. You know, I think they finally got the joke on that one. But it was just an incredibly stiff SUV. It was really uncomfortable to drive. And you know, it's like one of these experiments where they're trying to combine sports car and SUV. And you're high up off the road, and every bump makes your spine sort of, you know, my spine was like an accordion by the time I gave the car back at the end of the week. It was an awful drive. It was terrible. Oh, and then I don't know what it is with the transmission, but until you get to about 20 miles an hour, you're doing this. I don't care how you feather the accelerator. I mean,
rubber banding.
Oh, it was terrible. This was a bad driving automobile. Mm-hmm. It just was. Now, I'm sure I'll hear from Nissan PR people tomorrow telling me, well, if you knew how to drive, you wouldn't have that problem on the low end. You know what? I had somebody at Lamborghini tell me that because I was driving the Gallardo Superleggera, and it's one of these things where it was the first year they had the Superleggera version of it, and when you hit the brakes, almost nothing happens. You push it further, almost nothing happens, and then you get a centimeter further, and your head's in the windshield. Yeah. And I wrote that, and they said, well, you know, you're just not familiar with these super-powered cars. So then I opened up Car and Driver when Chubba Chetta was still the editor-in-chief and read his review, and he had the same problem. Say what you want about Chubba. He knows how to drive. So there are cars out there that still have, you know, issues.
How about that Ferrari 458 Italia video on their site? Did you see it?
No, I haven't seen the video.
It's just like brings you to tears.
It's probably going to be the last mid-engine 8-cylinder Ferrari.
Yeah.
There's aspects of that car that I think are really good, but I think Ferrari, from a styling standpoint, stopped evolving about 10 years
ago.
But
the best part of this is you got to go and watch. They do this video thing, and you hear startup, and then... You know, I'm kind of an old school, I like to shift myself until I saw that video. I mean, I've watched countless Formula One races. Yeah, I get it, the paddles, it's all cool. I don't want it on the street. I saw that video for the 458 Italian. I said, oh, me likey.
I'm a staunch paddle shift advocate if it's
really
a fast, good tranny. And dual clutch trannies are the way to do it. No doubt about it.
Oh, and this Ferrari is like, ging, 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 you're gone, man.
And you talked about Ferrari design, and I think what's happened, the last Ferrari that was, and it's highly controversial, but I think the last spectacularly good Ferrari design for what Ferraris are supposed to be was the Enzo, because it's the only Ferrari in about the past 15 years where they haven't poached the bin of some previous Ferrari and done it as a new design. It was a modern car.
And the Italia has some.
It has some of it, but they still have done a little bit of that picking at.
It's better than the California. I can't stand the California.
Peter, what you just said is the same as saying you were the healthiest man in intensive care.
That's true.
I mean, the California.
But the California is so bad, I can't.
The irony is, the California is in a way the F50 again. It's an incredibly cynical way of prying cash away from very rich people.
Oh, it's all about prying cash.
Yeah, but it's very cynical in the way they do it.
Yeah.
Because if you look at that platform that it's derived from, the truth is the 8C is a spectacularly designed car.
Yes,
it is. Yes, 8C is gorgeous.
You sandpaper your eyeballs to get an 8C. But it suffers from that far less than successful.
Ferrari should finally, once and for all, just one car, not go to Pininfarina. They should do something altogether different. I'm telling I love the brand. I love the mark. I love the heritage.
You can't
But I think they're stuck.
Except when you blame it on the outside design studio, it's like blaming the advertising on the agency.
I hear you.
The client approved the people putting makeup on a Buick. Okay, the client approved that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't. The California, the cynicism around the California. I wrote about it, and I got broadside by all the. I'm sorry, I'm not wavering. I stood and looked at it at the Paris show, and I just couldn't stand it.
A friend of mine did find the best angle for the California, though.
Where is it?
Rearview mirror.
Oh.
Which makes it just like Wolfsburg, Germany.
They should have just gone with a soft top instead of, you know, compromising everything from...
Think about how many retractable hardtops suffer from the fact that because we have to package it, they end up with these prematurely terminated roofs,
mm-hmm.
where all of a sudden the arc of the rear window, they tighten it more than they should. Now, if you were designing a Jag, I could probably buy that, because that's what old Jag hardtops looked like. But short of that, you just compromise the way the products look. That's why, in some ways, I say God bless Audi for continuing to stick with soft tops for the convertibles.
And BMW.
No.
The Z4 is a hard top.
Oh, the new one, but yeah. I mean on...
And the 3 Series is a retractable hardtop.
Right, but on the... What was it?
The Boxer's still soft top.
Well, the 6 would have a retractable hardtop if they did it now. I'm sure it would.
Boxer's still soft top.
Does anybody want a convertible?
Yes.
Why?
It's like having 2 cars. And I don't even have protective hair, and I want a convertible. You know, I must wear my jaunty baseball cap of some sort that I staple to my head.
It's the one. I love my Mini. I love just about every Mini I've driven. The Clubman. Especially the JCW Mini convertible, terrible. Loses all the body rigidity. You can squeak and rattle.
But you didn't say who wants a Mini convertible. You said who wants a convertible. And at that level,
I have the same
I'll say I want
with
one.
Convertibles, and I think they're for 50-something guys. No offense.
I hate you, David.
By the way, hold on. We mentioned Mark Royce in the beginning of the show. And there's one fact about Mark. He told me this in an interview years ago that we have to bring up. Lloyd Royce is not his most famous relative.
No? Who no. is?
Former Los Angeles Dodgers pitcher Jerry Royce. He told me that.
Who?
Jerry Royce used to pitch for the. You're a geek. You don't know anything about sports.
I grew up in Southern California. I would go to the Dodger Stadium once a year to get a Dodger dog.
Some of the better Dodgers teams in the 70s and early 80s. I was in an interview once.
Related to him?
I was in an interview once, and it was the first time I interviewed him. I sort of wanted to break the ice, and you know, his dad got fired in an awful palace coup, and I said, "Look, I got to ask you a question about a relative of yours," and he sort of got, you know, a little bit kind of serious look on his face. He said, "You related to Jerry Royce?" You know, I'm a baseball junkie. And all of a sudden he starts laughing. He's like, "Oh, wow, nobody ever asked me that." He's like a second cousin or something like that. So there we go.
There we go.
Okay, John, you are...
Oh, no, I was going to say, we got to get into this German provision because you wrote your column about it. I wrote a blog, an auto blog about it. And it's just, to me, it's infuriating.
Well, tell us about it, John.
Well, if you don't know the details,
there, it's confusing me.
You know, here the federal government in the state of California has said, you know, CO2 is destroying the planet. We have to do something about CO2. So all you automakers, we're going to really ratchet up the fuel economy standards because we've got to save the planet. And then turn around and exempt almost all the most gas-guzzling, CO2-spewing, expensive European performance cars.
But before that, they eliminated the provision for manufacturers to pay fines, right?
Well, they said they were going to. Yeah, I don't know if they did that.
Yeah, they did. But the thing about it is it's called the German provision because the German manufacturers, specifically BMW and Mercedes, were lobbying, look, if we sell less than 400,000 units in the U.S., then, you know, let us bring over some of our super sedans because your people like them.
Well, which cars are exempt? I mean,
you're talking things like the S600 Mercedes,
AMG,
all the AMG stuff, all the
but it's
M
only
stuff.
The really high end stuff. It's not like they get a pass on the 3 Series.
Well, their argument is
according to the Journal, a quarter of their sales in this country will be exempt. A quarter of their sales. To me, that's not insignificant.
But it opens up a can of worms. I actually like the fine bit. I mean, I like, you know, if
you want to sell and pay.
Yeah, if you're an enthusiast driver and you happen to like that and you have the mic, hey, you know what? That's why we live here. We're supposed to have the freedom of choice, right? Okay, if you want to spend that kind of money, it's your right to drive that vehicle.
Well, look, this has been the argument for it to do, instead of CAFE or even just with CAFE.
Well, CAFE sucks, but that's a whole other issue.
Okay, keep CAFE, and if you did what the Europeans do and you tax gas and even have a tax for displacement of above a certain level. Then, if you want to drive, you know, S600s and M5s and stuff that guzzles gas, and you've got the money to buy them, then you can pay for the gas and you can pay a tax on the engine. It becomes something for the true hobbyists who are into driving fast cars and boats and stuff.
Isn't this related to the S-curve?
What do you mean?
There's a thing called the S-curve in the CAFE standard.
Yeah.
And it
I've seen it.
Yeah, it has vehicles that are performing better than segment average. You get an overage that you can apply to vehicles that don't. But the problem is the German vehicles don't have vehicles in that area. So, I mean, I really do, in that respect, I understand it. They should perhaps have them do a fee, like a tax on those vehicles. But because they can't take advantage of the S-curve, because of their product range. I mean, remember, in the first proposal for CAFE, the mandate was for 35.5 miles per gallon fleet average by, and General Motors had to get at that time 36.4, Toyota had to get 34.9, and Porsche had to get 41.4. Okay. Right. Now, there's something wrong if your corporate average is 35 that you're saying these guys have to get 41.4. So this is really to address that, isn't it? It's to address the shortage of these manufacturers at the low end of the S-curve.
And Maya, you know, I don't really have a problem with it as long as it's applied fairly. And if you want to buy it and you want to add a buyer's premium, I don't care.
We had a gas guzzler tax.
Yeah. Why? And so they eliminated the fines of the manufacturers, and they think this is better.
But
no,
can you
it
imagine GM, Ford, or Chrysler saying, hey, we've got these big honking SUVs, and we won't sell a whole lot of them, but please give us a CO2 exemption.
God,
it would never happen. The other thing, too, is these vehicles that we're talking about from Mercedes, BMW, especially them, these are the halo cars that create aspiration for the brand. It allows them to sell all this other stuff.
What happens when Infiniti and Cadillac and Lincoln want to come out with some big super luxury car that competes head to head with?
Not even super luxury. The CTS-V is there now.
CTS-V is every bit right there with those cars.
CTS-V and an M5, you can use those cars in the same phrase.
The difference is GM can balance it off
with the S-curve. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, see, and here's this is the problem with one of the problems with CAFE is, okay, you've got all of these companies arguing for different things because it is incredibly complex, and the S-curve is even more complex. Mm-hmm. And you could accomplish what you wanted through taxing gas, taxing displacement, all these other things we've talked about here and I've written about and you guys have written about before. Now, here's something even more perverse about the S-curve. It basically goes through all the segments of cars based on the footprint, and you've got miles per gallon targets based on the car's footprint. Now, under the first proposal, and they haven't issued the new rulemaking to give us a new S-curve, Tom Stricker, who's Toyota's Washington guy for environmental stuff, walked me through this at this energy symposium out in Portland last year. The XD, either the Scion XD or the XA at the time, I forget, but the smallest Scion.
No, it was the XD.
It was the XD. Missed its target by 1 or 2 MPG. I think the target for it was like 32, and it was 30 or 31 MPG, okay? The Avalon beat its target by 1 or 2 MPG. So he said, to meet our CAFE numbers, we actually have an incentive here to sell more Avalons than XDs. Now, what does that do for the planet? This big gas guzzling Avalon polluting down the highway and chugging gas bought off these Saudi Arabians.
It'll make the planet more restful because, you know, the Avalon is a restful car. It's like driving to the clouds.
But there's another aspect to this whole thing, too. It's if you've got a bunch of money, these CO2 regulations don't apply to you. If you're just an ordinary Joe or Jane, forget about it. You got to meet the law.
Well, they had the opportunity. They should have eliminated CAFE. And they should have said, okay, we'll have a gradual increase in the minimum price you're going to pay for gasoline in this country, and then you make your decisions accordingly.
CAFE can work if it has a carrot, because CAFE is just a stick, and it beats on buyers, and it also beats on the manufacturers. But if there were a stick, either for the manufacturer to offset some of the incremental cost of advanced technology or for the customer, you can make CAFE work. But that takes imagination
and vision.
No. Exactly, because I'm probably in the incredible minority, but I believe a CAFE system with a carrot as well as a stick would be as it would have the same efficacy, really, as taxing gasoline without the automatic political suicide of raising the tax on gas.
I don't know. You're going to have to explain the carrot to me because I don't see it yet.
There are a bunch of ways it could be done. It could be done at a manufacturer's level to offset incremental cost on advanced technology clean cars.
So you mean the government gives them money if they do better on CAFE?
Yeah, well, no. If in other words, you could do it a couple of ways. Let's say you're getting a Volt, and rather than pay the $43,000 for it, General Motors has said, here's the incremental cost of that. So you buy the vehicle, and over the period you're buying it, you are rebated the differential cost.
Well, that's not complicated.
Well, no, but the reason you do it that way is it washes out the incremental price of the car when they go into the used car park that way. That's the secret. Because if you don't do that, you end up with Priuses with carpool stickers in California, where you can have two identical used Priuses, Prii. If one has the carpool sticker, it's worth about $4,000 more. And the whole idea is if you want to proliferate the technology, you have to get it into the used car park in significant numbers, and you have to make it affordable there. So that's why it ends up as convoluted as that. Mm. But gas tax is political suicide.
Yeah,
that's why everybody's afraid of it.
All I know is that all these years of CAFE trying to, you know, green America's fleet, we did it. We did it about 3 months a year ago when gas was up. All of a sudden, it was just like, wow, didn't take long.
The line of demarcation was about $3.80 a gallon.
Yeah, we've had a lot more snow that winter.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, you saw, I've got a chart from Experian Automotive, and there was around $3.80.
But the thing
compacts and mid-sized cars spiked.
But it's segment-specific for where the pain is, so it varies from segment to segment where that threshold is. For somebody that's not buying a new car, that's got a used car, and has a rather limited income, that threshold is a hell of a lot lower than $3.80.
Now, the problem with just saying a gas tax is political suicide is that no one's tried to float it beyond going up to consumers and saying, hey, want to pay more for gas? And the more you pay is going to go to the government? Those dirty guys who are trying to screw you at every turn?
So how else would you sell a gas tax?
Well,
we'll all have puppies. Come on.
No, what are you going to do with the money? I mean, one of the big arguments against it is that low-income and working-class families are going to, and people with bigger families. Yeah.
If you go to Americans and say, do you like shipping $700 billion a year overseas to a lot of countries that don't like us so we can buy their oil? No, goddammit, I hate that.
Right.
Okay. Now I've got some buy-in. Now let's start talking about how we get off it.
You lower income taxes for the people that it's going to affect the most.
Send them a rebate check. If you're under, make up a number.
Look, what do we use? 1.4 billion gallons of gas a year in this country? Isn't that what it comes out to?
It's gallons.
A lot more than that.
More than that.
10 million barrels of oil a day goes to transportation.
42 gallons of gas per, I looked this up the other day.
It was 42 gallons per barrel, but you're going to get half of that in gasoline. A barrel of oil yields about
50% of refined gasoline.
Right. No, but the statistics I was looking up were barrels of gasoline sold. That's how the DOE, I think, reports it.
Was that the Jed Clampett survey?
No, jackass. And I was trying to calculate how many billions of gallons of gasoline we consume, and if you have a dollar or $1.50, $2, it raises a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And then you tax breaks to the people who get hurt by it. And then what are they going to do with the money? They're going to spend it on something other than gasoline because they'll probably buy a more efficient car because they see the pain at the pump.
Yeah, if you're at the poverty level and you've got a car, we'll mail you a check once a quarter.
We're talking about convoluted payments.
Yeah, we sure found out.
Oh, the IRS already has the money on how much everybody makes. So, look, NHTSA doesn't even, they're looking for people who know the product plans of the automakers so that they can figure out future CAFE for all the companies because they don't know. So at least the IRS already knows what we make.
They really? I didn't know that.
We sure found out, though, a year ago.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
In dramatic fashion.
But we also found out how short people's memories are.
Oh, yeah.
I was stunned by that.
I wasn't.
I figured people would go back to buying the Guzzlers, but I didn't think it would happen in three months.
It's like everybody's saying now, America's going to be very frugal and start saving again. No. Wait till the economy comes back and people start making good money again. It's going to change
You had $14 trillion lost out of the economy in vaporized real estate,
mm-hmm.
share value, corporate collapses. It's gone. That money is gone. I was looking at a company that was forecasting vehicle sales, and they said, it's going to be up to 16 million units in 2 years.
No.
No, it isn't.
No.
People aren't, you know, people that buy cars and used to do a reflexive buy every 3 years, some people are going to hold on to them another year. We'll put that money back in the 401k. A lot of middle-income homes are trying to recuperate the loss. That's going to keep money out of circulation, John.
Plus, remember that when you look at national savings figures, that also includes debt payments for credit cards, home equity, and everything else. So, look, the savings rate hit 6.9% in May. Now, that was artificially high a bit because a lot of that is tax rebate checks going into people's savings accounts and paying off credit card balances. But you're still going to have going out quite a ways. I mean, look, I've talked to some knowledgeable economists when I was working on that boomer story, and a lot of them see savings rates going up to 10% over the next 10 years. Alex Partner says they see it going, based on surveys they did with boomers, going up to 14%. Now, we were at below 2%, actually for a lot of last year, below 1%. Just going from 1% to 5% takes $400 billion out of consumption. If it goes to 10, it's $1 trillion out of consumption.
I know what everyone's saying. I'm telling you.
I know you're saying about you know, American culture, and we don't learn and we go back. But the thing is, if you go back to guzzling gas, you just pay more money, you know, but you sort of get used to it. When your savings is wiped out and your home equity is gone, it doesn't come back when the economy comes back. You have to rebuild all of that.
There's elasticity in it. There's a hysteresis where there's a delay, and there's going to be a delay, and the delay could easily be a decade.
Yeah. Well, I do have a name for this show tonight, John.
Which is?
Downerville.
Yeah. Well, you guys did blow about 15 minutes on the automotive porn segment with Ferrari talk.
What's your point?
So, Jim, is GM going to turn this around? Do you see them really getting their act together? I mean,
it's GM's game to lose.
Totally.
They have.
But it always was.
No, it was not. When they had the burden they had with fixed costs, debt, and so on, it wasn't their game. They didn't have it. It was not a done deal. Now, think about it. Their debt load has been sliced in half functionally. They've got good products. They don't have to spend money on basically pushing on a rope trying to sell some nameplates. So what they have to do now is it's just one thing. They just have to convince people that they should buy a GM car.
Toughest job in marketing history.
Exactly. But it's their game to lose because of that. Because everything else they've got right. Their product range is good. They've got stuff
products
in the pipeline that is going to be absolutely, in some case, segment leading. Yeah. And in segments, they have never led. So all that stuff's lined up. They have to, one, they have to market their way out of the problem they're in while not forgetting that product will have to support the marketing.
What do you make of marketing coming under Lutz?
They needed to do something. And it'll be interesting to see. I mean, you know how Lutz works in a highly unconventional fashion. Mr. Lutz had sort of a group of shock forces that he has to put into play on things. He needs to do that for marketing.
Will the culture produce what needs to be done? I mean, the government came in and solved all their problems for them. Everything that you just mentioned.
Right.
The government came in and straightened it out. And thank God they were too big to fail, or they wouldn't have gotten that kind of help.
Let's just say if the quote-unquote GM culture is put to sleep, they'll have a shot.
Yep.
But if the long knives come out, the bad juju culture comes back, then
they're done. I think one of the reasons for the thinning of management, the way they're thinning it, is to get rid of a lot of the inertia in the system. The bottom line is that the autoimmune system in any organization, private industry, government, you name it, is astonishingly robust. The sad thing is that for American business, entropy is the norm. It really is for things not to happen. And yeah, I mean, think about it. General Motors has never, in modern times, come to the edge of the pit and have people look over the edge and start throwing rocks down and not hearing any sound and going, it's deep. That's happened to Ford. It's happened to Chrysler.
Several times.
Yeah, but it has never
happened to GM. You're right. Yep.
It happened. It was, for a lot of employees, it was an oh my God moment. For a lot of employees, it's like, we're GM, we're going to get through this. There are fewer of the latter in the organization now. They're winnowing down a lot of people.
Is Fritz the right guy to run the company?
You need continuity at the start. You've got to have continuity. You can't bring a guy in new to do it. He has to understand what the product plan's been. And my personal opinion is, yeah, he's an okay guy to do it. He really is. Because you bring somebody in new, and the first thing he's going to have to do is, one, learn the auto industry. Because where are you going to buy an exec that can do that, that has the operational and product background, because you need a guy that
Ford,
has both.
Ford got the only one, Alan Mulally.
But he was a fast
learner. The only outsider,
of,
yeah.
Right, but he was a fast learner on some of that, too. That's my point.
Right.
But he was able to do the learning, so you've got to get a guy and train him. And the training period at Ford, while it was daunting, I mean, remember, that was when their cash burn was spectacular, and you had executives actually warming their hands on the burning money. But it's worse now. The curve the guy at GM would have to have is even more.
And there's no ramp-up time anymore.
None.
Well, look, I mean, this has been the big burning question about Henderson being CEO. Is he the guy to change the culture? And Jim's right. I mean, at a minimum, in the beginning, he is, because and I did a story on how he's trying to do this, and I interviewed him about it, and I, you know, and you'll never get him to say Rick wasn't managing this company right, but he's blown up a lot of what Rick was doing. And people told me that their performance reviews, they had, you know, a dozen metrics. Some told me more, upwards of, you know, 20 metrics or something ridiculous.
No,
they had a lot of committees. So, you know, Fritz won't say, you know, Rick was doing a lousy job, but he's cut it down mostly to 5 core metrics for everybody. And if you're in manufacturing, something where you've got quality and other things like that, you'll have a few on top of that.
Yep.
He got rid of the automotive strategy board. Things are done in smaller meetings, fewer people on the committees. He's cutting the time of the meetings and finding the work is getting done.
They're doing stand-up meetings, too. No seats in the room.
Meaning what?
You're standing up.
That's how they did it back at the tech center in the 50s when Ed Cole was there at Chevrolet.
They're doing stand-up meetings. You don't sit down. You don't get comfortable. We're going to get through this.
Ah, makes everybody want to get out of there quickly.
Darn right. You have to resolve it.
In fact, at the old Chevrolet building, there were no meeting rooms.
That's right.
If you bring in somebody new, how long is it going to take them just to realize how decisions are made, how checks are cut, how money is allocated, and where all this stuff actually happens? I mean, you got to find out where the machine gun nests are to go blow them up. Mm-hmm. And it could take, I mean, especially in a company the size of GM, and you look at, the, you know, first thing he took out the regional heads. You don't have a group vice president for Latin America, Europe, North America, and Asia Pacific anymore. So that's been flattened. And then you're seeing a lot of other VPs go away, and, you know, it is a flatter organization. I mean, there's still a big management core there, but it's, you know, they're going to be able to make decisions quickly. Now they just have to make the right ones.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of those decisions now, instead of being product decisions, are suddenly marketing decisions. And that's something that historically they have not been the best at. GM has used its inertia to good effect, really, far better than any other large inertial corporation I can ever think of. And that is one of the problems, because they let the inertia go to the point where they didn't realize how irrelevant they had become to some customers. They didn't even believe it. It's like, nah, yeah. I mean, I remember hearing the things, oh, the people in California, they're crazy. They're just crazy. They are. They're crazy.
Well now with four brands instead of 8, it's, you know, you're not contriving some sort of brand image or marketing message for a brand like Pontiac or Oldsmobile or something that they haven't been able to sell.
So you're pretty bullish on GM going forward, are you?
They have every opportunity to get it all right. But now it's going to be a marketing. The next decade is a marketing decade. It is. And I hate to say that, because people think, well, you don't think product's important. No, you'll be able to have the best darn product out there. And if you cannot adequately market it to a group that you need to sell the volume you need, you're going to be in trouble. Well, that's happening for GM 3 years early.
Yeah, we were just talking about the Chevrolet Equinox.
Exactly.
The new one.
Mm-hmm.
Spectacular. But convincing people it is
going to take some doing.
Yep. Yeah. But it is an astonishingly, I'm starting to think it's probably the best thing in the segment right now. And it's one of those things where the four-cylinder is unbelievably refined.
Yeah, the consumer should definitely check out the four-cylinder version of the Equinox.
First time I got in the car, it was raining. Got in the car, I about cranked the ignition, and I looked down and the tach was running. I was like, I don't believe it.
Really? Was that quiet?
Yep.
Nice.
What about cash? Yeah.
Check your email. There's a breaking story about cash for bunkers.
They're out of mind.
They burned through the billion already? So does that mean if they've used the billion up, we've sold a 250,000 cars in, what, 4 days? I'm impressed. Hey, I wonder, now, if I worked for a major magazine that or publication that dealt with dealers a lot, I could turn that into a SAR of like 70, 80 million. You know? We've turned the corner. Why is it when people talk about SAR, they forget the first two letters are seasonally adjusted, and they'll take whatever the last month was and times it by 12? I don't understand the math.
That's right. You got to know how to seasonally adjust.
Yeah, most people.
So what's the breaking news?
Is it that they're out of cash and cash for clunkers?
It says cash for clunkers to be suspended.
Whoa.
That's gonna
too good to be true. And I was just watching today on the news. They had cameras at dealerships showing all the clunker cars in the back lots, just marked clunker, clunker. And some of those vehicles, you know, I was impressed because those are collectibles of the future. I must say they're devastating the car collecting craze by taking things like S10 Blazers out of the market, two-door S10 Blazers in shocking pink or purple. Peter, that will devastate the collector car business.
I absolutely agree.
Well, here, gonna, you guys are going to
fund
this.
You think they're going to fund another $3 billion on this?
Oh, no way. I don't.
What do they say, Jen?
They're going to burn through $950 million by midnight. Now, the Journal this morning said that they had burned through just shy of $100 million.
Right, $98 million.
Right,
bucks.
Right.
So that was about 10%.
10%.
So that means they've
just
done.
Just like you said.
Yeah. That means that they've actually gone through another 90% today.
Yeah. Well, probably all the paperwork just came in, and they went, holy moly, we're out of money.
People started going to the dealerships looking at the deal.
Well, that means the June SAR is going to be at $16 million
or higher. I mean,
it's going to be outrageous. Because you're right. That was going to translate into about 200,000 vehicles.
250,000 because it's the two split levels.
But I did the math on at least what the Journal reported, and it's like there aren't many going out for $3,500. The average, again, based on that 22,000-plus units at just shy of $100 million, it was about $4,300 average.
You know what that means? That means we should look at smart sales.
Why don't you think they'll fund the other $3 billion?
Because I don't think there's a whole lot of stomach for it. I mean, we just burned through a billion like that. And the only reason that billion even was made available, it was tied into a military spending bill.
Oh, but
so everybody had to approve that.
City could go through that much money faster than that.
Well, yeah, but they don't get called to the mat in front of Congress either.
How much of it is in the pickup market? Because that's what this was really... It was tailored to be much easier to sell new pickups.
Well, you know, we had Art Spinella on last week and asked him that very thing because somebody had told me Art was the one who was... And Art said, no, what it really turns out is that if you've got an old pickup and you want a new pickup, you qualify like that.
Yeah.
So now if you've got some car and you want to get into something else, then it gets real funny. But
it
for
does.
Pickup buyers, it's
it
real
was
easy.
Very clear. Here's an example.
A 10-year-old pickup got 18. The new ones get 22. Boom, you're
I have
in.
A friend with a 2000 Crown Vic. Doesn't qualify because it was rated at 19 mpg that year and not 18. Now, the 2000 and 2001 Crown Vics were rated at 19. The 99s and those beyond 2001, I think, were rated at 18, and they would qualify because they did something like with the rear axle ratio or something that year.
No, it made more power. It was much more powerful.
For those on the podcast, you can't see the look of sarcasm on Jim's face. Right?
Sarcastic moi.
But this is, breaking news. That's very interesting.
No, but look, I mean, I never liked the bill. I mean, look, it's going to sell a bunch of pickups, and that's fine. But, in terms of greening the planet, no.
Well, look, and Carlos Ghosn came out in Europe and said, look, we've got to have a post-scrappage scheme, as they call it over there. That's what they call cash for clunkers. Because he says, once the stuff dries up, sales are going to crash. Then what are we going to do? So we got to start putting money aside for once the scrappage scheme expires. And that's the nut house stuff that you get into. You pull all these sales forward, or you make everybody rush into the market. And what did Chrysler say? So, one out of three buyers didn't qualify, or only one out of three did qualify.
One out of three qualified, yeah.
That's what I wrote about. I originally said this thing had problems because not enough people would qualify, either because what they were trading in didn't meet the mileage requirement, or they weren't going to get. They didn't want to get into something, or they couldn't get credit. Look, a lot of people have cars that are that old. They're not new car buyers to begin with. That's a point Edmunds.com made.
Right.
That most new car buyers keep their cars for 4 or 6 years, so they're worth more than $3,500 or $4,500. They were the people who qualify are never in the used market. Because they can't get credit or they didn't have enough money.
A lot of kids got new cars out of this, actually.
Yeah, that would.
They really did. They had the old car for the kid.
I think it's a lot of contractors with pickup trucks because they qualify very easily, and those guys drive those things around forever. I mean, what do you care? I mean, your work crew doesn't care if all it is a bench seat, a heater, and keys inside, and it's an ancient truck.
Looks like we've got our questions.
Uh-oh.
Ben, put up the graphic. Okay, it's time for a rapid fire, and we all get about a minute. We all seem to go way too long on these answers.
No, well, I'll be the horn blower today.
Okay.
We're going to move through.
Horatio Hornblower?
Alex Kovnet asks, how did the EV1 handle?
It handled like a Fiero, with the rear track narrowed by about 6 inches and with about 900 pounds of gasoline condensed into 1 gallon. It was not a very good handling car. And it had low rolling resistance tires from the Whirling Dervish radial manufacturer.
Which made it even better.
Yeah, it was not a good handling car.
Okay.
But it accelerated like a son of a gun.
We can move on.
Arnie Nashbar asks, how can the U.S. government allow the German automakers concessions on CO2 emissions?
How can they allow them? Lobby money? I don't know. I mean,
well, clearly the German lobby is quite effective.
I never knew they had any kind of muscle. I mean, BMW's paid about $90 million in CAFE fines this decade. They have a bunch of credits right now, but they paid a lot in fines.
I suspect it's somehow tied to NATO.
Are they sending troops to Afghanistan? Some more troops, maybe?
No, but S-600s.
Okay, our timer is ticking. Ronald Wright asks, what car sold in Europe or Asia would you like to see come here?
Ooh, the Renault Megane.
Why the Megane?
I just like that little notchback kind of thing they have. I think it looks cool.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. The Renault Versatis was very cool when it was out.
Oh, that thing was awkward.
I take a Renault Avantime. If you're going to go weird with rear Renault, Avantime, yeah. The four-door or the two-door hardtop minivan. What is wrong with that vehicle description? Everything.
That one takes the bakery.
Yeah.
Or the charcuterie.
Okay, I hear the ticking. Artemis77 asks, is the Flex the new minivan?
No, I think it's the new American station wagon that people will grow to like a lot.
So it's the new SUV, really. Traditional SUV. Because that's what the station wagon devolved into SUVs.
It's the Chevy Traverse, I think, is the new minivan.
Treehugger asks, just wondering when the mainstream car buff print magazines like Car and Driver, Motor Trend, etc., will realize how irrelevant they are in this internet world. Does anyone even look at these magazines anymore, much less buy one?
They're looked at, but, you know, we all know that the hardcover magazines are fading. I mean, they all have internet components to them now.
And one of those magazines mentioned has a rather effective internet component. They really do. Where the editorial comment is common, and the editorial staff is common. So it's the same voice. The others don't, which is weird because logically that's how you do it.
You have to do it.
Right,
David. This one's for you. Joseph asks. I see all the publications like Business Week and Forbes have Detroit bureaus. Besides the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, are these real news bureaus like in L.A. and New York, or are these bureaus just a guy with a laptop and a BlackBerry?
Actually, we have two guys with laptops and BlackBerries. I'll have them
now. Wow.
No, we have two, Kylie and I, in Detroit. Yeah. We used to have three, but we've downsized. But you know, we have an actual bureau in Royal Oak. We've got old Ward's data books and all kinds of stuff. You know.
So, and you guys go to work with, like, caps with little cards that say press in them, right?
Yeah, and then we take those off and we put on the little green
visor.
Shade.
Yeah, cool.
But actually, the Journal has a big bureau here in town. Bloomberg's got a big bureau here in town.
Well, Fortune does not have a person here. Alex Taylor covers the auto industry out of New York.
And Joanne France.
Joanne Mueller is the one person in her home office for Forbes with the BlackBerry and the, although knowing Joanne, she probably doesn't have a BlackBerry, just a laptop.
So Joseph, you're right. There are some people, it's just a blacktop. Or blacktop and a lapberry.
A lapberry. I'd like, you know, there we go. There's technology.
Okay, Reno Diggs asks, to get a younger buyer into a Buick, do you think the Buick Crest would need a completely new design, or would it make more sense to retain the current Crest and create a new identity by making a younger model?
Product does it, not badges.
Yeah, the new Buick designs are quite stunning, and what they've got coming are even more stunning.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And people, we were talking about that a few weeks ago, people have no idea what's coming from.
But you know what? That's GM's problem. They're going to have the product that they need, and they are going to have to market it a darn sight better than people putting makeup in cars in the surf. Really. I mean, the marketing there stinks.
Yeah.
Stripes Cardigan asks, why have GM and Ford never been able to build a decent minivan? Is it that hard to reverse engineer an Odyssey or even a Grand Caravan?
A story that may take a little bit longer. I had a friend at Chrysler, and I was working at General Motors at the time, and the Lumina APV had come out, the plastic pig, the dustbuster. Yeah, and this guy says, why didn't you guys just copy it? They said, we did. But in the process of copying it, there were these people who wanted to make it better. And the same thing happened to Ford. They were copying it, but then they decided they had to make improvements. And the problem is, as soon as you start making it better by your own subjective call and don't understand the buyer, you're dead in the water. So think about it. You know, the Dustbuster was a copy.
Huh. Nobody's going to invest in the minivan market now.
Well, now. But this is going back to why they didn't in the past.
I mean, because it's a three-company game.
Both those vehicles, the Windstar missed by a mile. But the Windstar played up safety, which actually bought them a full plant for a while, because Chrysler dropped the ball on safety on the minivan. And you think about it logically. If I've got a vehicle I'm carrying my family around, do you want it to be safe? Nah, I don't care. I just want it to have sliding doors. Wrong.
Pedro Fernandez asks, do you guys believe that GM's decision to eliminate the deal with Toyota in the NUMMI plant was another bonehead move from a clueless company, or was it Obamanomics?
No, it was neither, because Toyota is closing the plant.
Are they?
Yes.
Are they? I'm not. Are they?
Yes. Here's the deal. There was one product they could have gotten out of NUMMI if they wanted to that they needed. Small pickup.
Mm-hmm.
They're closing down the Shreveport plant where they build the Canyon in Colorado. And Toyota's only plant right now for the Tacoma in the United States is the NUMMI facility.
Right.
So the idea of getting a vehicle off that is interesting. The problem is they have all this excess capacity at both Princeton and San Antonio.
They have a plant in Mississippi that...
Yeah, but that's not a body plant.
But they've just got too much capacity.
Yeah.
It's probably their highest cost plant in the country because you've got California taxes, California utility rates, UAW... Yes.
It's not.
It's one of them.
It's not the highest, trust me.
Princeton?
I don't remember.
Oh, he remembers very well which one it is. I'm with David. I'd say it's NUMMI. But MudMonster37 asks, when GM starts selling on eBay, will the Aveo be at a negative price? I guess you don't have to answer that one, right? Are they going to sell on eBay? I mean, is that going to work?
They're going to sell on eBay, but it's being done in California. It's actually being done through local dealers. It's not a bad idea. But it's, you know, if anybody thinks that's suddenly going to spike sales 20% in California, they are strongly mistaken.
Goat Rope asks, why does Hyundai do so much better in the J.D. Power quality surveys? They're way ahead of Toyota and Honda. I don't think they're that far ahead.
Here's the deal. This has been this way for a number of years. When you buy a Toyota now, the point is you expect a lot. Your expectations are very high. You buy a Hyundai, you don't have your expectations. The average person's expectations aren't the same, and the Hyundai's a darn good car, so they're going, wow, this is great. But if you go in buying a Yaris, for example, thinking it is going to be absolutely bulletproof and everything's going to be right, and you get it, and it's like, oh, it's a small car. So, it's what do you expect when you go in? Because all of those questionnaires are basically tests of your memory for what happened over the last 90 days, and what did you expect to get out of the car? Historically, the two Korean brands have had people go in with lower expectations and great cars.
And they've said that about Buick for years, that the older buyers had been in Buicks, and they had...
That was their level of expectation.
Yeah, and they had no frame of reference because a lot of them are pretty loyal buyers.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a phone call. Somebody did call in on our Google number here. John Phelps from Lake George, Louisiana. He's got a question about Ford. Let's hear the question.
Hey, John, Jim, and the gang. My name is John Phelps, calling from down in Louisiana. My question for the guys tonight on After Hours, the future of Ford Motor Company, what do you think? They didn't take the government money. Did Mullally get the turnaround started in time? You think that they can pull it out? You think they're going to come out on the backside of this stronger than everybody else with a great product lineup? Looks like they've got a lot of new products in the pipeline. Discuss. Tell us. Exploring Minds want to know. What are your thoughts?
It's a good question. The reason they didn't take the money, though, is a little weird. There are two kinds of stock at Ford. There's basically Ford Preferred, their common stock, and then there's stock that's held by the family. There are about 164 shares of that the family doesn't own because of some bad marriages on Hank the Deuce's part. But that stock, the family gets paid for holding that stock. So to the federal government, that would be categorized as a dividend, which if they took federal money, they would have to stop paying. The other thing was that when Mullally took out the home equity loan on the company, which seemed crazy when he did it, turned out to be a brilliant move. A lot of it, though, was leveraged through Citi at a very low rate. And guess what? That's one of the burdens Citi's still carrying. But truthfully, that was brilliant on their part, and they're getting their product right. You know, it's a good combo.
They've got some great products coming.
Yep. So they're also going to come out of this with more debt than GM, and they're going to have to carry that burden.
That's the issue. That in that respect, Chrysler and General Motors have been given something that Ford cannot duplicate.
However, Ford's got something that neither one of them have, and that is momentum.
Correct.
Serious.
The big mo.
Yeah.
And they're in a position where they can see their consideration build without going to weird marketing things to say, look, we're not really that as bad as you thought.
Yeah.
So, and that momentum has a serious net present value.
They've got momentum, but to pay off that debt, they're going to have to, once they get beyond this, the encore has to be, we can tell you that this company and our products are more than just not as bad as those guys are.
Well, I think they're in a position where they're saying that already.
And no, they are, but they're going to have, but they're going to have to go beyond that. They're going to have to say, okay, I mean, you know, their products are pretty good, but I'm not bowled over by their products. But I think they've come back pretty nicely. But they're not great.
Give it one more design generation. Okay, Chris Wittrock asks. I wanted to ask Jim and everybody else. How does he see Chrysler surviving until product from Fiat starts rolling in?
Well, let's see. If you look at Chrysler from a viability standpoint, from a profit standpoint, they have two products that get them cash.
Dodge Ram
and the minivan.
And minivan.
They get them cash. What they have to do is continue and find some way to get people to do those in a thing that gives them enough cash to get through this, because Fiat doesn't want to pour a lot of money in. Now, the Cinquecento, the Fiat 500 is going to be sold here, most likely not with a Fiat badge or a Chrysler badge, but with a Cinquecento badge. That product will get some buzz at a dealer level where people are going to go, rrr. That can get them a little bit of time. It won't get them volume or money, but it gets them sort of awareness, which they're going to need. But the product, until they get through the product, they have the toughest job right now, by far and away, because they don't have new stuff in the pipeline after the Grand Cherokee.
Okay, when's the Grand Cherokee coming?
Grand Cherokee's next calendar year, and I want to say second quarter, third quarter, sound right?
I thought Grand Cherokee was the end of this year and 300 was next year.
No,
it's not this year.
It's in 11.
The Grand Cherokee, I think, could be sensational for
it. It can. The problem the Grand Cherokee has, you know, it's a great vehicle, but it's a segment where general consideration is down because it's that whole thing. It's an SUV, not a crossover. Now, you know, you could say if you want to chase its lineage back, it's based on and the new one's based on an E-Class Mercedes. That's a car. But the point is, its perception is so much an SUV, and consideration of the segment is so far down that they have to sell it as being more than an SUV. It seems to be a very, very nice vehicle. I saw a CRD actually on the road that was badged CRD because they're running them around without disguises in Detroit.
Hmm. Okay, two open questions on Chrysler. One, will the small Fiat cars come, you know, engineered in Europe, will they make them any real money here to save the day? And two, if they have 8 to 10 points of market share and they're marketing four brands because they're going to bring Alpha here, how is that not as ludicrous as eight brands at 20% share for GM?
They're not bringing Alpha here. You have to understand how Alpha is being done. Alpha is being done really by Italy, and what they're using out of Chrysler is the back shop. They're using him for warranty administration.
Sell the Alfa Romeo brand
They'll
here?
Sell it, but it's going to be done through an entirely different dealer franchise or a dealer agreement. It is not going to be. Trust me, it's not going to be captive Chrysler. There will be some Alpha dealers, I'm sure, that will not be Chrysler dealers. And the truth is, they got the Chrysler dealers so they can run the back door, warranty administration, vehicle distribution. That's that part of it. Parts and service. That's the part they're going to use from Chrysler.
Okay.
But it's not part of the Chrysler marketing initiative. The Chrysler marketing initiative is three brands. And whatever they're trying to do with Mopar, I don't get that one at all.
Yeah, I don't get it yet either.
It's going to be headquartered in New Jersey.
The new 300, Chrysler 300, when does that come?
Well, I think it's like 3 to 6 months. I think it's 6 months after the Grand Cherokee. The problem with that car is that's another one where segment consideration is generally down. Now, they can hope that the segment gets a bump from Taurus. And who here has seen the new 300?
I have.
It's pretty striking.
I've only seen pictures.
Because it looks like a 300, and it looks very, very good. The Charger looks like a bloody Charger. It really looks like a Charger. So those cars are great, but they're segments that generally are not what they were even 2 years ago.
I'm not optimistic about Chrysler. I don't care how you frame it, how you talk about it, what they're going to do in the next year.
They're going to have to survive with the minivan and the Ram. That's what they're going to have to do.
Good luck with that.
Mm-hmm. No, it isn't going to be easy.
Well, I think the Grand Cherokee will help. I think the Cinquecento will help. I think the new 300 will help. But, man, that's still balancing on the tight wire.
I think it's all a big plan to just have Fiat North America here. That's pretty much what it's going to end up being. Fiat North America with Jeeps.
See, the funny thing is they're going to get revenue darn soon because Fiat wants Jeeps for export. And that's actually going to get Toledo and Toledo West, the one on the other side of the freeway, going pretty good because they really do want export. That's why they bump start the CRD program on the Grand Cherokee. It was going to be a later program because the Fiat dealers actually globally, they can move probably 100,000, 150,000 first calendar year if they wanted to.
That's a lot of volume. That'll do a lot for that plant.
Yep. See, their footprint's going to be
that's
larger.
That's a lot of cash flow right there. I mean, that's a third leg of the stool.
And the thing is, the footprint from Fiat, their market they have available, they're actually where they want to distribute Jeep is larger than what Chrysler or what Mercedes did when they had it. You know, their best sales for Jeeps in export were the year before the acquisition by...
Is that right?
Yeah. You know, what does that tell you?
Tells you a lot.
Think about it. If they could max out a minivan plant, Ram plant...
Maxing out a minivan plant is going to be really, really tough.
One plant?
It's going to be tough. Because the minivans...
Well, they need a crossover in there. A big mistake they made was getting rid of Pacifica.
I'm not sure.
They don't have the product.
I agree. They just don't. I agree, but that's why I say they're going to have to do whatever they can to keep...
This is something, you know, when Cerberus bought them, you know, I did this piece, Cerberus's lowball strategy, and all it was cut, cut, cut. And now, you know, Nardelli was blaming the Germans for not filling the product pipeline, but they cut so much that there's not much coming after either.
Yeah, the problem is they cut the product coming out. The product we have now is the product of that incredible automotive genius, obviously Dieter Zetsche, who approved the Sebring, as far as I can tell.
Wow. And Wolfgang, too.
Yeah, Wolfgang was there. Well, I think he approved the Avenger.
Yeah. Hey, we're at the top of the hour here. You know, we sort of wrapped up last week's show with an old ad. Remember the Chevy Citation, the first Chevy of
the 80s.
Right.
Chevy Citation.
So Michael
Banovsky. It called the Condor.
Oh, would have been a better name.
Release the Condor.
Well, Michael Banovsky found another classic ad for us and from Banovsky.com. And, Ben, let's just run that ad. I think that's a good way to finish up today's show.
Will we be able to see it on this magic screen?
We will.
It began as genius and grew to be legend and has become at long last the most advanced production car on the planet.
This is the end of the volcano popping on the floor.
With the Kiss drummers.
Peter Christensen?
You'll see.
A Corvette superb in its engineering and technology and defiant in its performance.
You had to drive it apparently with a fire suit.
Feel the performance of the world's first computer-activated manual transmission.
Remember how horrible that was?
Yeah, skip shift. They didn't call it that.
Is that what it was, the skip shift for Cafe Reese?
Yeah.
Wait till they talk about the sound, the audio, and the stereo.
Oh, there's the stuff popping out of the
liquid crystal displays, 14 separate instrument readouts, English or metric, all updated 16 times every operating second. You never heard anything like this before. An available Delco Bose stereo with four never-before speakers, separately engineered for sound that's out of this world. Never before. The most advanced production car on the planet is now called Corvette. Chevrolet is taking charge.
That was the car that was engineered on the skid pad.
Yes, by Furyk Schatzma.
To deliver heroic numbers, but it was almost undrivable.
Well, that was because they used an I-beam in compression for the spring.
Yeah. I mean, you know, on smooth pavement, yeah, it was great. But
last network Corvette commercial ever produced.
I was just going to ask, when was the last time you ever saw a television ad for a Corvette?
I did a commercial, though, for Camel Ewald, and we actually had a Corvette at the end. It was called the Yeehaw Factor. It was about all the, you know, we do all these safety things and all this good stuff, but in the end, you really have to take into consideration the Yeehaw factor, and at the end, it was a ZR1, the first ZR1.
Right.
That was the last time, but that's the last dedicated
No, the second commercial. ZR1.
Yeah. What's the first?
Oh, yeah, the first, okay, yeah.
1970.
Yeah. Did you have a hand in that last
Yeah.
Not this one, no, the one I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah.
So what's the best automotive ad ever?
Shit.
Somewhere west of Laramie.
Probably that's the best tagline of all time for George.
I like the Ken and Barbie and G.I. Joe Nissan ad.
Oh, God.
That was awesome.
It was awesome, except there was something basically obscene about that ad, that they're using the Z car in it, and it was a year after they canceled the Z car.
I know. It was
maybe next week.
It was dumb in that sense.
Maybe next week Michael can find the Trans Am spot that I did that Pontiac used to hold up as this is what we need to capture this spirit, and it was directed by my friend Tim Newman, who won the first MTV Video Director Award a shot at night in L.A.
Which Trans Am?
The 84 or 5.
Third generation F car.
Yeah, we shot it in 84. It was like a nightmare shoot, but it turned out really well. We had this guy with these python boots on. And it was
There's what a commercial,
about that,
David.
What about that Cadillac with the dinosaurs?
Oh, yeah, there's David's commercial.
I love this commercial. Yeah.
Well, we'll see. Michael Banofsky, you've got your challenge there to see if you can find Peter's ad, though, if I know Michael.
Because I've got it in my archives, but they're not even DVDs. They're so old, so I don't even think they can be resurrected.
Well,
one of my favorite old commercials, though, was a Renault Dauphine commercial. seriously, and it was playing off...
In the United States?
Yeah, in the United States, it was playing off the short film The Red Balloon. And they had balloons out of the top of the Renault Dauphine. It's driving, and there's a scene with it driving, and there's this guy with this, like, cream cheese strained through lingerie kind of voice saying, "It's a good-looking car. Fun to own, fun to drive, fun to repair." That last part I didn't say, but the first two things were in it.
Well, we ought to wrap it up. It's past the top of the hour. We've got to let some people go here. But Jim Hall, great having you here. We're definitely going to have you back again.
I can come back.
Yeah. David Welch, good having you. Peter DeLorenzo, great having you here.
Watch for David at the Highland Games.
At the Highland Games.
Throwing a caber while he plays his bagpipe.
I'll be piping all day Saturday.
And remember... we're going to have our Out-of-Line store is up on the website right now. You can get hats and shirts and mugs and DVDs, including our Emmy Award-winning program for Out-of-Line Detroit. You can go to outoflinedetroit.tv/store. Shipping is included in the price.
Did those winners get their stuff? They didn't write back and say, "We like it" or anything?
No, we did get an email from one of them who, in fact, it's up on our website right now. He was very thankful. Yeah, no, and, you know, just astonished that he won, you know. Any of us who have ever entered contests and never won anything can sympathize with him.
And he got an Autoline T-shirt.
Yeah, right.
Boy, you're cynical.
That's a dumb
He's Mr.
Squib.
Downer.
Yeah, he is.
Well, they got an Auto Extremist T-shirt, which are rare.
Yeah.
Because we don't sell them very often. If you request and act nicely, we can send you one, but it's...
But you will pay for shipping on that.
No, we just give them a flat rate and send it, you know.
Remember, follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/autoline. You can follow Peter at twitter.com/autoextremist. Join us again next week when we'll have Kurt Ritter here. We'll talk a whole bunch about advertising then. He used to run a bunch of advertising at GM and is now running Saatchi LA and doing all the Toyota advertising. So, but thanks, you guys. Great having you here.
Thanks, Tim.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Out-of-Line Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out-of-Line Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outoflinedetroit.tv. Orange, purple, silver, and blue, change of frequency.